Despite opposition from city officials and the public, JEA is now taking bids to sell 16 of them. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, we've got the latest on the push to privatize JEA. Where do you stand on that? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the debut of WJCT's eerie new podcast, Oddball. But first this hour, the city of Jacksonville has owned JEA for some 125 years. But that all started to change this week when the publicly owned utility began accepting bids from private companies, 16 in all. The sale of JEA seems to be moving right ahead, although some members of the Jacksonville City Council and most of the voting public is opposed. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union has been covering this, and he's here now with more. Hey, David, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Where do you stand on the sale of JEA? Give us a call. It's 549-2937, 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa N. Jax, and our Facebook page is open too. Okay, so JEA opened up for bid on Monday. 16 interested parties, you report. What did you learn yesterday?
Well, we don't know the identity of most of those, but we do know that the three investor-owned or privately-owned utility operators that make up the bulk of Florida's operations are in the game. That is NextEra Energy, which owns Florida Power and Light, Emera, which owns Tampa Electric and Peoples Gas, and also Duke Energy, which is a huge southeast regional utility.
JEA is valued at anywhere from $7 to $11 billion, according to different evaluators. Do we have any idea how much these bids are for?
We don't know any of that yet. There's no details that have been provided, and we won't know that until sometime in February, probably.
Okay. JEA has cloaked this process in secrecy, although they claim to be committed to transparency. That doesn't seem to pass the smell test with the public out there. 75% of Duval Countyans say they oppose privatizing JEA. So what to make of the pushback on to the utility CEO Aaron Zahn and the board that they are conducting this in secrecy without full transparency to the public who owns the utility?
So the argument is that it makes sense for them to have confidential negotiations. In the same way, if you're selling a house, you probably wouldn't want different buyers to know what the other one's offering. So that's the argument behind it. They also argue that it would hurt that competitive process to even release the names of those entities that are interested. You know, that seems like that's a very unusual approach to take. Obviously, some companies, when asked, have confirmed they're interested. They're publicly traded. So I don't really understand completely why it is that that part of it is being cloaked in secrecy, because let's face it, these companies are going to figure out who's on the opposite side of the competition for JEA.
It's 549-2937 to join us. What are your thoughts about JEA moving ahead to sell off to a private operator? They took 16 bids yesterday, and you've been reporting, David, and so have others, that the leadership of JEA has claimed over a period of several months now that they have no choice but to sell off this publicly owned utility to a big private industry player like Florida Power and Light or Duke Energy because their financials are so terrible. The data doesn't show that, though, does it?
Not in the current data at all. In fact, JEA at its last board meeting talked about how great they've been doing. I use words like phenomenal and success story when they looked at their past year of financial and operating performance. So if you look at a snapshot of where they are right now, they're a good, solid, well-performing utility. They get good marks for customer ratings. They have been able to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in cash for upgrades to plants. So you look at it and you go, this is not a utility that is reeling and in trouble. Their argument is that they're looking into the future and they're seeing things coming up in terms of changes in what the utility industry landscape looks like. And the best way for me to sort of compare what they're looking at in terms of it is it's all about assumptions, right? You make certain assumptions and then you get to certain conclusions. And we saw this in hurricane season. You looked at those maps the spaghetti maps where you saw lines going all over the place.
Right.
Right. Well, different models had different assumptions, so they had different lines of where this hurricane was going to land. It obviously ended up going one place, right? And there was a big divergence. So part of what might be helpful, and I think City Council is going to be looking at this, I think, is, you know, what are their assumptions and how much of their assumptions are in the mainstream of what utilities are looking at? How much of it diverges from that?
There are some on the Jacksonville City Council who have spoken out against this rapid push to privatize JEA. City Councilman Matt Carlucci, Councilwoman Randy DeFore, the former CEO of this company, Michael Boylan, now on the City Council. They've called for the City Council to get engaged in this process and vet this notion of selling JEA. Where is that likely to go?
Well, yes, I don't know. They're going to be meeting later today, Tuesday, to kind of look at what their next steps are. They're obviously working with the Office of General Counsel, the city lawyers, to see how far, how much they can look at this in advance of actually getting something from JEA board in the spring saying, here's what we'd like to do. So I don't know. We'll see a little bit later whether they're going to have some public meetings, public hearings, whether they're actually going to have their city council auditor look at it. They talked about hiring their own attorney who would have expertise in this, would be able to say, here's the questions you should be asking that you should know at this point, and figure it out sooner rather than later.
Let's talk about the mayor's role in all of this. It's widely assumed among the political chattering class that closely follows City Hall doings that Mayor Curry had this as a priority, that he purposefully cleared the JEA board of its prior membership and installed his own appointees so that, the thinking goes, he could move ahead, install a new CEO, which he did in the person of Aaron Zahn. That was a controversial pick. To privatize this utility, take the windfall, and use it to work on a number of projects around town without raising taxes. The mayor denies this, let's be clear, but the political narrative that's emerged around what's going on behind the scenes around the sale of JEA comes back to the fourth floor at City Hall. What about that?
Well, when this first came up in 2018, Mayor Curry supported what JEA was looking to do at that time, which was explore privatization, the potential sale of the utility to potentially an investor-owned utility. And then that all cooled off when there was a lot of public backlash. There obviously was an election. And during the election, he told voters he would not file any legislation with City Council for the privatization of
JEA. That's a very carefully worded statement.
It's carefully worded. You know, what if JEA brings it forward, does he still keep his campaign promise? I think, though, when you're a voter, though, you're not immersed in all the ins and outs of what statute he's referring to. All you know is there is a message from the mayor that he would not file legislation for privatizing JEA. Then after the election, obviously everybody took office, and then JEA came out really quickly with this decision to privatize, or not privatize, decision to explore privatization. And Curry has supported that. He's praised it, says that this is what they're doing right now is what he had hoped they had been doing a year or two ago.
Around the country, cities that have investor-owned utility power are dissatisfied with it and looking to go back to a public, municipally-owned utility framework, which is what we have here.
Right.
So what about that? So those who oppose the sale of JEA, and it's some 70% of Duval County residents, have pointed to that as saying if JEA is sold off, the city loses the annual contribution JEA gives the city, $130 million, right? Something like that?
It's about $118 million right now.
$118. So they've argued you're killing the goose that laid the golden egg. You get a one-time payoff, but you lose that money over time, and you deal with the vagaries of a privately owned utility. The other argument is privatization would result, I guess, in better service for the customers.
Yeah, I don't hear the arguments of much better service. JEA has really high marks for customer service. I think the concern would be the flip, which is that if it's sold off, that you would not have local control, local accountability. You might lose some of those performance. You might not get as fast a response when there's massive hurricane damage because you're owned by a group that's got a lot of other territory that it's having to respond to that's also damaged. Let's have to emphasize how rare it is. And you mentioned, Melissa, some cases where other entities are looking to go from private to public. Here in Florida, there have only been in 20 or 30 years, only two sales, maybe three sales of a public entity to a private investor for a utility. It's very unusual, very rare in the electric side of things. And so it's unusual, and it's even more unusual that by JEA being the eighth largest utility, municipal mm-hmm. utility in the country.
Okay, let's go to your calls now. As we speak with David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union, throughout he's been covering the controversy over JEA's push to privatize. Where do you stand? We'll go to your tweets in a moment, emails and Facebook comments, but right now let's take some calls. It's 549-2937. Sandy is in Riverside right now. Hi, Sandy. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm 82 years old. I've lived in Jacksonville for about 50 years now. So I have a little experience with JEA and with Jacksonville. And this is the silliest thing that the politicians have ever come up with, and probably the most crooked. That's the only word for it. Keep it secret so you know none of the bidders will know what the other bidders did. If you were selling a house, would you want to sign the papers without knowing what everybody had bid? Of course not. Secondly, JEA's service has improved terrifically in the last few years. I haven't had a power outage in I don't know what all, and I live pretty close to Five Points, so I'm pretty close to downtown. Their recovery time has been better than anybody else in the country for coming back after some kind of a problem. When the mayor put his little pet in as CEO and loaded the others in there on the board so he gets it the way he wants as far as votes go at JEA, but he's afraid to let the people vote on it because we're the real owners, aren't we? I am, you are, everyone listening is, and everyone who doesn't listen is, whether they like it or not. We need to make the decision, and we need all the information. I want to see what these bidders' track record is. Not that I want to sell anyway. I've seen what happened in California.
What happened there?
Oh, the outages. They had rolling brownouts. The rates immediately skyrocketed, and it's still going on. Part of Southern California was without power a couple of days ago.
Okay, Sandy. Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, David. Sandy articulated the view of many voters out there. They see this process as corrupt. They believe the fix is in and that the public is going to be cut out of a debate over the fate of JEA. Can you explain the mechanism that City Council passed when this first came up a couple of years ago? Councilman John Crescenbeny at the time, I think, led on this. He was able to pass legislation that would give the public a say before the utility is sold off.
Absolutely. So at one point, basically, the city charter, which is the guiding document for the city government, said JEA can do whatever it wants if it's going to sell less than 10% of its assets. That's within the hands of the board. And then if it was more than 10%, they had to go to city council, and city council also had to approve that. John Crescenbeny basically said, that's not enough. The voters own this utility. They should have the final say. So the city council changed the city charter after voters overwhelmingly voted in a non-binding straw ballot referendum that they wanted to have that say. It was like 70% plus. So what it means is if the JEA board decides it wants to sell or privatize JEA, and if city council agrees that that's the best thing for Jacksonville, then the final say goes to voters in a countywide referendum. That could happen sometime in 2020. And if it passes by the voters, it's done. If the voters say no, it doesn't happen. It's over.
So ultimately, the voters could stop this process.
Absolutely. They have that within their control if it gets to the point that it gets to a referendum.
But what if it doesn't get to that point? What you're saying is city council, before they sign off on the sale, they first have to put it legally, it's a binding matter before the voters.
Right. There's 19 members of city council. They have to be convinced as a body that that would be the best thing for Jacksonville. They could look at what JEA comes forward with and say, no, we don't agree with it. It's not good enough. send it back and tell them to try again, or just tell them, you know, we've seen your what you've come up with, and we don't think that's the direction the city should go. So city council could stop it with a no vote, a majority no vote.
Is
as
that
well.
Likely, though? Is that likely?
You know, it's not likely because there will be this pressure to say, let the voters decide. That's always a strong argument. They probably will have a deal that, by definition, meets the minimum requirements of like more than $3 billion for the city. That's a substantial amount of money to say no to.
And we can certainly expect a PR campaign trying to influence voters around this. We'll see television ads, mailers. The messaging war will be intense, I'm sure.
Some would argue we're already seeing
with
commercials and advertisements and mailers to JEA customers talking about debt spirals and going off financial cliffs.
Let's go to Willie in Jacksonville now. Hi, Willie. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm against the sale of JEA, and I've worked for JEA for over 30-something years. I started with JEA in 1959 and moved up the ranks. My concern is, and I've called before, hire someone who knows something about utilities. We ought to get the message. If 16 other people, companies, want JEA, they see something we don't see. And just like JTA, they went and got someone who knew something about transportation. And look where we are today. We have moved forward, did a 180-degree turn. Find someone who knows something about utility. JEA started going downhill when they started promoting from within. Once you start promoting from within, and I'm a product of what happened once they started, they start getting rid of friends. They and doing favors for friends on promotions.
Willie, what about the fact, though, that they chose a CEO in the person of Aaron Zahn, who was installed as a board member and then quickly elevated to CEO? He was an outsider, and that move was criticized by many who said he wasn't qualified for the position.
And I agree. I agree. Find someone throughout this United States who knows something about running a utility.
Okay, well.
And if they do the homework.
Thank you.
They do the homework.
Thank you for that.
They will go back and see.
Sure. Yeah. Former employee speaking out. And certainly the employees, aren't, from what we've heard anyway, including the union that represents some of them, are not in favor of this.
No, not at all. I mean, there's great opposition from within the ranks of JEA employees. Certainly there are JEA retirees who have a lot of questions about how this has all been played out. And if going back to the assumptions, disagree strongly with the assumptions that JEA is using for future.
Michelle is in Riverside. Hi, Michelle. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me on. Mm-hmm. Well, and what I have to say is we need to, everyone needs to go and look up California when the IMF trick of stealing public utilities was tried there. Overnight, rates went triple. They withheld available power from nearby grids to drive the price further. And in this time of vulture capitalism, the people that work there don't even count on your pension if this happens. They are lying. They will get around paying your pension. They are stealing our public utility. That's it. That's the bottom line.
Michelle, thanks for your thoughts. Okay. Hearing on the lines, people really angry about this. They feel that something not on the up and up is underway. That's the perception anyway. And let's get to her comment about the pension situation. Beginning with JEA employee pensions and the utility saying they will be protected throughout the process. What is your reporting uncovered on that, David?
So on the pensions, basically people who have pension obligations that are coming to them, either current employees or retirees, they're going to get those pension benefits. If there is a sale, those pension benefits will be paid by Jacksonville City Hall. and they would absorb the cost of several hundred million dollars of unfunded pension obligations that right now are in JEA's books. So people's pensions are going to get paid, but it is going to come at a cost to Jacksonville taxpayers because it's no longer going to be something paid but through the ratepayers of JEA. And in terms of protecting employees, I mean, there are some protections in there in terms of all the career uncertainty that they face, that they're going to be able to continue to get retention bonuses, that, you know, there'll be a period of time where they get the bonuses and pay even if they're transferred. But it's not perpetual. I mean, JEA was a place where people went to start and finish careers. If there's a sale, that's no guarantee that's the case, and there's no telling how many people are going to be at JEA or whatever the utility is in this area 10 years from now, for instance.
We have so many tweets about this. Here's one from Stephen. This sale process reeks of a cover-up. The mayor and the CEO tell tales of despair to push the sale for financial causes. It's all moving too smoothly to allow a public vote. Don't be surprised when the charter is changed and bypasses public outcry. Here's another tweet. Please bring to light the real reasons for a JEA sale, the bailout of the mayor's failing pension plan. What about that?
Yeah, so the idea on the pension plan is that right now, voters approved a couple of years ago a half-cent sales tax to pay down this huge pension liability, which the current administration inherited from years and years of problems. And that pension half-cent sales tax is supposed to start like around 2030. If there's a sale of JEA, then the mayor has talked about using some of those proceeds to pay off the Better Jacksonville Plan half-cent sales tax, and that would start this pension sales tax faster. In and of itself, that's a good thing. The faster you start paying down that pension debt, the better it is, because it's like paying off your credit card debt faster. So I don't know that it's necessarily an effort in and of itself to bail out the pension problems. There's an argument you could make that that could be perhaps in the best long-term interest of the city.
Many tweets. Here's a few more. Duke Energy is a poor steward of the environment. They created a toxic mess in North Carolina and won't clean it up. And they want the ratepayers to cover cleanup costs. That translates to more rate hikes. That's certainly been the argument against privatizing, the fear that people's rates would go up. Another tweet, the previous caller is right. There are no subject matter experts on the JEA board, and there haven't been for a long, long time. Maybe that's part of the fix. One more tweet for you, Mr. Bauerlein. How will the decarbonization trend affect the revenue and value of JEA and all of these secret bids? The issue needs to be discussed in public before JEA staff makes their findings. There are so many tentacles to this story, you know, and it's remarkable the way the public is really engaging and following this. Here's an email from Andre. The mayor and his gang are crooks. They won't allow the school board to directly ask through votes money to fix schools, but they're setting us up so they can sell off our JEA. They are lying about this. People are angry about the JEA journey, and they're angry about another controversy, the holdup on levying a sales tax for school improvements. Those two things together are having a profound impact on our local politics.
Well, without a doubt. Now, Tommy Azzurri is not saying anybody's lying, but he's talked about a credibility gap, Tommy Azzurri being a city council member. So there's a real sense among some city council members that they want to get the straight truth on this. And certainly you hear that from voters a lot, that there's a skepticism and that they simply don't believe that JEA's in the financial fix that JEA says it's in. And then on this half-cent sales tax first.
And let me just jump in. Here's a tweet from Councilman Matt Carlucci. We got an insert Saturday in our JEA bill from the authority's chair saying they were in a death spiral. Who would want to buy that? The CEO of JEA said at last week's board meeting that JEA's financial and operating performance is better than ever. Then why sell? That's from City Councilman Matt Carlucci on Twitter.
Right. And that kind of gets to the whole point. Is JEA selling a utility that's damaged goods? Or are they selling a utility that's thriving and prosperous? And JEA has said both things about it. On the one hand, they've said our financial performance has been never better. We're doing great in terms of our last fiscal year. On the other hand, they're saying, but we're going off the cliff. We're in a sinking boat. We're headed towards this slow but certain death spiral. Which is it? And how do you reconcile those two very different portraits of this utility? And so, yeah, Matt Carlucci got that mailer. So I'm sure that's one of the questions that he will be asking and would want an answer from JEA about as they move into this next few months of potentially council drilling down and trying to get at what's really right and what's wrong.
Let's go to Kirsten in St. John's now. Hey, Kirsten, are you a JEA customer down there?
I am, yes. And I actually have two comments. First, yes, I'm a JEA customer, and I would wonder, is there, if it comes to a referendum vote to approve or reject the sale, would those non-Duval County customers be included in that, one? Two, on the comment that was just made around the, you know, what is the state of the finances of JEA, bring in an independent auditor, bring in Ernst & Young, bring in KPMG, bring in somebody who can do a real deep dive into the books and figure out what exactly is the state of the utility so that we understand, we as, you know, customers and voters, we would have a reasonable understanding and all of the information that we need to make a valid decision.
Okay, Kirsten, thanks for that.
So in the question of whether St. John's County residents or customers of JEA would have a vote, the answer there is no. It would just be for Duval County voters in terms of any kind of a referendum. If there's a, for the water customers, there's something where St. John's County might have a right of first refusal to purchase the territory that's served by water customers if there's a sale. There's some moving pieces to that. And then to the comment about an independent auditor, I mean, that's the thing, that you can do that for the current books, and they look pretty good. They're not like a utility that's going off the cliff. The question is, again, what assumptions do you plug in for the next 10 years? And that's where, yeah, it would help to maybe have somebody come in from city council side and say, here's some different assumptions, and maybe have a different outcome in terms of those.
Can they demand that? Can they get that?
I think that's what we're going to talk about in their meeting. I mean, I think they have the authority to hire an attorney. Could that attorney also have subject matter experts that attorney works with to really develop their own analysis of it? And can the city council auditor, who's independent, also do that same kind of analysis?
David is in Deerwood. Hey, David, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Go ahead.
My name's David Foster. I was born and raised in Jacksonville, and I've lived here for 84 years and practiced law here for almost that long. The sale should not be made until the owners and customers of the facility approve it, at least the owners. And number two, the fact that we don't know what the terms of the offers are is unacceptable. An analysis of the offer should be made by an industry expert, not just a CPA or not just a lawyer, but an industry expert. And certainly the CEO of JEA is not an expert. And the top five or six or some other small number of the best bids should be made public. At that point, each bidder would be allowed one more opportunity to lay on the table the best and final bid offered by that particular bidder. And at that point, the owners of the facility, namely taxpayers and users, would vote to approve or not approve. And without approval, no sale would be made by this mayor or any future mayor. And what the CEO recommends can be laid on the table.
Okay, David.
But his approval or her approval is not a condition of the final decision by the owners.
Thanks. Thank you, David. Yep. Thank you, David. Thank you for that. Let's get a few more of you on the air. Thomas on the west side. Hello, Thomas. What say you?
Good morning. Well, I'm glad that someone mentioned the pension thing, because I think that's been part of this, too. Because if you remember, if you have a long memory, there were people that doubted if the funds it was going to raise were ever going to be sufficient to cover what it had to. And I am very, very dubious of how this is being forced on us and how it is being done in secret. And the thing I'm most skeptical is the dividend they're talking about, which to me seems like they're just planning on trying to buy votes for this sale. Like I say, the whole process seems rigged, and I think we need to speak out and we need to stop it.
Thank you for that, Thomas. You know, here's a comment expressing the same sentiment, David. It's on our Facebook page. Brenda writes, we need to find the loophole that they are hiding, meaning city leadership, that allows them to bypass city council and voters. There is no way they would be so bold without having this, meaning the idea that people think forces working behind the scenes will find a way to go around the public and the city council to push through this sale.
So here's the potential loophole. City council has the power to change the charter. I mean, they could, by a supermajority, 13 of 19 votes, could change the charter. And they could say, okay, you don't have to have a voter referendum on the sale of JEA. So that would be the potential loophole. That would be something to watch. Would somebody on city council come and say, let's do that? I don't really think that would be politically possible. I think the voters made plain, loud, and clear exactly what they wanted to see happen in that non-binding referendum. But still, that was the will of the people there, and there'd be politically very difficult for city council to budge for change from that.
William in Jacksonville. Hi, William. Good morning. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
The bottom line here is that the voters, the users of JEA have nobody to blame but themselves. They keep electing people like Lenny Curry, whose approval ratings were in the toilet, and yet he got reelected. They keep reelecting the same snakes over and over, and you can't expect not to get bitten when you keep electing snakes.
Whoa, okay, strong words from William. Not everyone, let me just be clear, those are not, we are not calling the mayor that. That said, you know, there was a low turnout in the municipal election. This is a reminder for those out there, and there seem to be a lot of them, that are unhappy with what's happening with the utility, that elections have consequences. Depending on who gets in, things could change in a way that you might not like.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, if Anna Broche had defeated Lenny Curry in that election, we would not be having a discussion about selling JEA, because she was very emphatic during the campaign that she thought it was a silly idea, that it should never come back again. And that was her position. She staked out without any kind of caveats. So, yes, elections make a difference. What happened, I think, in the spring elections was JEA was no longer a front and center issue. It had kind of been moved.
People thought it had been resolved.
Yeah, it was kind of like, well, it wasn't pending before city council. JEA had said, we're not going to talk about it anymore. The mayor had issued a statement saying he would not file any legislation for privatization of JEA. So it lost its kind of cutting edge there. And now that's not to say that anybody ran for election saying that if elected, they would support privatizing JEA. Nobody did. And they all realized it was an unpopular position, so everybody stayed clear of it. And then here we are after the election, and it's on the table.
Here it is again. We always count on your reporting and that of your colleagues, and we appreciate you being here to fill in all of the listeners out there on the latest on this. And thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll continue to follow it. That was the Times Union's David Bauerlein. And up next, we're going to shift gears a bit and tell you about the strange story of Jacksonville's Betts Sphere in our new podcast, Oddball. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In salt marshes along the southeastern U.S. coast, you may hear the call of McGillivray's seaside sparrows. These tiny birds build their nests in marsh grass.
But as the sea level rises, their nests get flooded more and more often, which causes the death of their offspring, and so they have to start all over when they're nesting.
Karina Newsom is a graduate student at Georgia Southern University. She says that when a sparrow's nest is flooded, it builds its next nest higher up off the ground.
But the problem with that is that when they build their nests higher, they are more visible to predators.
Like mink, rice rats, and raccoons. So near Brunswick, Georgia, Newsom is using cameras to monitor the birds' nests and predator activity.
My project is focusing on understanding how predation threat varies across their breeding habitat.
She says her study will give wildlife managers information they can use to better protect sparrows. For example, by building structures that shield sensitive areas.
There is hope because there are a variety of management strategies that can be employed
to help seaside sparrows have a better chance of surviving as the climate changes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Welcome back. Well, it is a brand new and out of this world podcast from WJCT Public Media. Take a listen.
In 1974, a family in Jacksonville, Florida found a metal ball.
Does the ball have any scratches on it or deep indentations anywhere?
It was also really heavy, silver in color, and although it resembled a bowling ball in size, it didn't behave like a bowling ball.
He said, "Dad, when I walked, it followed me." This is what he said.
The ball rolled from the center of the table all the way to the edge and stopped. And it was almost like, hey, don't forget me.
So, is your curiosity piqued? Host and producer Lindsay Kilbride is here now with more about the debut of our new podcast, Oddball. Hey, yep. Good morning, Lindsay.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. So you've been working on this for a long time. It's very exciting to see it now out to the public. What is the Oddball? Tell us about the Oddball.
Yeah, so I started working on this a couple years ago, actually kind of on my own time outside of work. And it just was a lot, which is good because it made for a really good podcast. So it sort of shifted to the side. I had done some pre-reporting. And then, you know, 7 months ago or so, I was able to get back on it and finish up the podcast. I'm super excited. So as you heard in the little clip there, a ball was found here in Jacksonville in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where some people, there's sort of a cult following over this ball, but a lot of people have never heard of it, especially local people, right? So it's sort of like people who are already into this stuff kind of know about this ball maybe. So there's
UFO enthusiasts.
Yeah, definitely. If you go on Reddit or something, you know, there's lots of threads about it.
Why was the ball odd? What did the ball do?
Well, you know, it's alleged, you know, I never saw the ball do these things, but I have interviewed lots of witnesses who, and the family who found it, who basically said that, you know, it had some sort of self-awareness. It started vibrating at first. It was, you know, like, you know, little, it was very heavy, this metal sphere all scratched up they found in the woods and started vibrating. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like it would kind of roll and just change directions in an odd way or go around a table and end up in the center. And there are different theories, like maybe the table was sort of, you know, the ball's really heavy, you know, maybe with it, you know, kind of making the table sink in certain areas, that would happen and stuff. But then, you know, it supposedly did this in lots of different places. The Navy looked into the sphere, and all of these famous UFO scientists did as well. And so it's kind of following all these leads, all of these a lot of different scientists found different things with the ball. So sort of like how renowned are these scientists? Like, how can you trust this versus this? And talking to modern day scientists and also just, you know, what this did to this family's life. You know, it's been hard. They don't really want to talk about it. So that's been sort of a delicate thing to juggle with doing the podcast.
A family with the last name of Betts found the silver sphere. They noticed all the strange things that it was doing. They had the Navy look at it. They had some famed UFOologists look at it. And then as you found out, the worldwide media attention really had a negative impact on the Betts family.
Yeah,
right?
It basically caused a lot of attention they didn't want. People were showing up at their house, men in strange suits offering them large sums of money, you know, according to them. And it got kind of scary, which that would scare me as well. So a lot of it is sort of looking into, like, who was this family also? And, you know, just I think, you know, there were all these allegations and it's sort of like trying to figure out who to believe and how, and following all those leads. So it's very interesting story. There's, I think, a cliffhanger at the end of every episode, which I just keep running into all of these weird little rabbit holes where you're like, okay, now we got to look at this weird thing. So it definitely keeps your interest.
People need to listen though to the whole podcast to find out what was this ball.
Yeah.
And was it from another world or not?
You look into all that. So,
I mean, I'll never forget when we first started talking about this. Gosh, it's been a couple of years because it was featured on Ancient Aliens.
Yes.
The strange story of the Betts sphere. Mm-hmm. And we all said, we'd never heard of this, even though it happened in Jacksonville, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've also partnered up with Bold Bean Coffee.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so right now, if you start listening to the first one, you'll start hearing some ads in the middle that you can listen to all of the episodes today. And that's because we have a binge package, and that's Bold Bean Coffee is included. So essentially, let me back up. Bold Bean created a special oddball coffee blend for us, which has been so exciting. So it's a special blend, and it's kind of a funky coffee, but it's very well-rounded. I think I'm drinking some right now, and it makes for a great coffee in the morning. So basically, you can order just a bag of the Oddball coffee. You can go on our website, oddballpodcast.com, and you can get a package. So you can get just all of the episodes right now and binge them all today for $20, or you can pay a little bit more for $50. You can get the Oddball coffee blend. You can get a cool Oddball mug, a tote bag, and all the episodes. So there's a few different options, or you can just, you know, buy a bag of the coffee or whatever. So the whole shop is on oddballpodcast.com.
All right. It's out now. It's our new podcast, Oddball. Lindsay Kilbride, thanks for sharing it with
us. Thanks for having me on. Listen to it.
Up next, why real men are wearing pink this fall here on the First Coast to fight breast cancer. We'll be right back.
Everything together. You know each other's secrets. You know what makes each other tick, and that's why betrayal hurts so much. On the next Snap Judgment, Turncoat. Storytelling with the B. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
ViStar Credit Union, focused on offering its members a safe and financially strong place to save their money and get the loans they need since 1952. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at vistarcu.org.
CNS Healthcare is seeking people who are experiencing memory loss to take part in a research study. Together, let's tackle memory loss and Alzheimer's disease. Learn more by calling CNS Healthcare at 904-281-5757.
The San Francisco Bay Area is home to big tech and venture capital and some communities left behind.
A lot of our residents are still, they're not qualified or not able to get the jobs that will pay them a living wage and allow them to stay in their community.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Inequality and a Warming Planet in East Palo Alto, California. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, the whistleblower who exposed Cambridge Analytica's role in the 2016 presidential election, the company harvested personal data from tens of millions of Facebook users and used it to target people susceptible to disinformation and conspiracy theories. Wiley had been the research director at the company. Now he's written a new book. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Singer-songwriter Liz Phair released her debut album Exile in Guyville back in 1993. It kicked off a career in rock music that spanned nearly three decades and cemented her rep as a feminist pioneer. Some call her a kind of Gen X Patti Smith. Her new memoir is about coping with life's haunting moments. Liz Phair, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, local men are stepping up this month during Breast Cancer Awareness Month and doing their part to fight breast cancer. Jared Graybeal and Chris Condon here now with more about the Real Men Wear Pink campaign. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. Good
Thanks
morning.
For coming. Chris, let's start with you. By the way, you are wearing your pink shirt this morning, looking very nice in your bright pink. You are co-chair of the campaign. Tell us about Real Men Wear Pink.
So Real Men Wear Pink is an annual fundraising campaign with the American Cancer Society and benefiting Making Strides Against Breast Cancer here in Jacksonville. We gather community and business leaders together to raise money in the fight against breast cancer.
And so wearing pink, which a lot of you are doing this month, is one way to raise awareness.
Absolutely. And the guys that we have doing the campaign are each working toward their own goal of $2,500 a piece. And we're just trying to get the word out to, to just kind of help raise awareness for access to care and just helping the overall cause.
Okay, Jared, you're not wearing pink today, but you are some of this month, right? And you're also trying to raise money for this. Tell us about your campaign.
Yeah, so we, as a group, we've done a couple fundraisers with the American Cancer Society, including a charity golf tournament, and most recently there was a Cocktails for a Cause. I think some of the guys were bartenders for the night, and all the tips that they made went to their personal fundraising goal. But tonight, and as an individual, one thing that I'm hosting in order to raise funds is a Yoga for Breast Cancer Awareness event.
Mm-hmm. And that's tonight.
Yeah, it's tonight. It's at Hotel Palms from 6 to 9. We partnered up with Yoga for Change, which is actually a partner of ours at Superfit Foods. And they're going to be hosting two separate 45-minute classes, one at 6:30 p.m. and one at 7:30 p.m. And the idea is that it's a free yoga class, but we're accepting donations for anybody that wants to get involved and help.
Okay, so this is an easy way to contribute. Just go, come on out to yoga tonight at Hotel Palms in Atlantic Beach, 6:30 or 7:30, and make a donation. That will help Jared meet his fundraising goal. Now, Chris, you helped raise last year a record-breaking $140,000 for Real Men Wear Pink here in Northeast Florida. This gets really competitive, too, doesn't it, among all the guys that are taking part?
It does. Along with this year's co-chair, Victor Patel, we really we started getting very competitive toward the end and pushing each other along to help raise money. The $140,000 was just a tremendous number. And it was just, it was really humbling and proud to be a part of this year's campaign as a co-chair. I think that we're hoping that these guys start pushing each other a little bit harder as we start getting toward the home stretch.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, this Thursday, October 10th, is Real Men Wear Pink Day in Jacksonville by mayoral proclamation. The whole city is encouraged to pink out and wear pink or throw up some kind of pink flag to kind of fly the awareness for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Is this a color that you guys would not normally wear? So what's it like to wear pink?
I don't mind it. I think pink looks good on me. no, and that's why I didn't wear it today, because I'm not sure if I would make the time to do laundry again by Thursday. So I've got a limited amount of pink shirts.
Limited amount of pink shirts. You've got on a pink shirt today, Chris, that I think we could see from space.
Well, last year.
And you look really good in it.
Thank you so much. Last year, I accumulated a few pink shirts throughout the campaign and trying to wear as many of them as I can throughout this month. we were definitely excited to hear that Mayor Curry signed the proclamation honoring what we're doing with Real Men Wear Pink. It's really it's a cool and exciting thing to have that recognition. And just by wearing pink, we can all be part of a movement that inspires hope and determination. Hopefully we can end breast cancer once and for all.
That's right. It is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. This October, 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in her lifetime. So Real Men Wear Pink is the guys getting involved in fighting this disease. They will keep fundraising through the end of the month. They'll also be at the Making Strides Against Breast Cancer Walk on October 19th, wearing their pink. But Jared, let's again mention tonight's big event so people can support you.
Yeah, again, it's at Hotel Palms, which is in Atlantic Beach. It's a really cool space. And we're going to be hosting two yoga classes led by Yoga for Change. One is at 6:30 p.m. and they're 45 minutes long. And one is at 7:30 p.m. Again, it's a free event. Come out, invite a friend, and just be willing to support with anything from $5 to a lot more dollars.
Yeah, whatever you can spare. So guys, it's great to have you. Real Men Wear Pink is such a great effort every Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So thank you, Chris Condon, Jared Graybeal. You'll see them around town wearing their pink. Come on out to yoga tonight. And on Thursday, wear your pink. Let's pink out the city for Real Men Wear Pink. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming by. That's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers as well. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. We always value your feedback. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, a closer look at the governor's plans to give Florida teachers a raise. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And if you're catching our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for some great music. We'll see you in the morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.